So, in many, many Unitarian Universalist congregations, and everyone I've ever served, at least once a year, there's something that is often called the question box sermon. And that's basically this. People get a chance to ask questions, and the ordained clergy person, the preacher, tries their best to answer them. For me, when I first went to the first congregation I served, they called it Stump the Minister. And invariably their questions were towards the ridiculous and trying to stump the minister. So it was often esoteric, arcane knowledge that nobody should know, but for some reason you just got to know things. But there was a thing that I learned when I was practicing, studying Zen. In many Japanese Zen monasteries, there's something called Dharmakamma. And when a student gets to a point where it is thought that they are ready to be a teacher, they stand before the Sangha, and the Sangha asks them questions. And the intent is to test the enlightenment, the awareness of the potential new teacher. And I've always thought that's a cool way to think about it. That each week, with lots of preparation, I say things that some people find interesting, some people find helpful. But it's interesting, I think, and I've always found it when I'm in a congregation that's doing this, it's interesting to see how does your lead minister think? What kinds of things are just there, ready to come out? And so the question box sermon, the Dharma combat, is my way of giving us this opportunity to test one another. Because it's also interesting to see what questions you ask. I do not promise to answer every question, but I will this week take all the questions you ask, all the questions the 1115 service asked, and put that out as a blog post so you can at least see what we're wondering about. So, first question. Important, they wanted me to know this is not a sarcastic question. What did you want me to ask? I hope that people take the opportunity to ask a question that's in their heart, something that you're wrestling with, something you've always wondered about, something that right now you feel you need to know. That sort of thing. I never promise to give answers, really. It's more responses. But I hope the questions are things that come out of your lived experience. What are your points? What is it like to need more? What is the escape for youth, the new generation, who are trapped in a formally in a family culture of hate and discrimination? Ooh, I prefer formal culture. What is the escape for youth, the new generation, who are trapped in a family culture of hate and discrimination? Well, not to be self-serving, I hope, but places like this, communities like these. I have never encountered youth in UU congregations who don't say this was the safe place for me. That somebody doesn't say, Unitarian Universalism saved my life. It gave me a different way of looking at the world. It gave me hope that the world could be different. If this is a question about physical harm and physical escape, that's a whole different set of answers that I don't want to go into here, but I could if somebody's specifically asking that, talk to me afterwards. But in a kind of more metaphoric sense, being among people who show that an alternative is possible, I think, is the only way. We are often told by the right that if we protect the environment and fight climate change, that it would hurt the economy.
Why wouldn't it be possible to have both? Protect the environment and make profits. Similarly, with gun control, why can't we protect gun owners' rights and make the country safer? We can't.
Next question.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. Although entrenched interests are awfully hard to move aside. But what do the rainbow colors represent in the UU beliefs? If be the rainbow colors, I think, that are used amongst other youth learn to associate with the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism. And I think they represent two things. One is they are a mnemonic device, so the kids are able to remember the principles, because each principle, as it's written for youth, the first letter of the principle phrase is the first letter of the color, so there's a mnemonic device built in. But I think it's also a way of tying to all the symbolisms of the rainbow. Hope, beauty, joy, wonder, LGBTQ equality, inclusiveness. I think it's all of those things. And so it has those two purposes. If you're asking me what the colors are and what they represent, ask me that. Where are we going with this? I have to. I'm universalist enough to believe that change is possible and not that perfection is our goal, but that the world not only can be a better place, but it will be. And so I believe that we are on track, long though it may be, to get to the creation of a beloved community that will make
what we're living in now look like the hell some churches threaten us with. Why are we here? To get there. To build that community. And I think each one of us, you know, is there a purpose in life? Maybe. That I don't know for sure, but I do know that we change that. I don't know if there's what I'll call a predicate purpose, that there's something prior to our arrival that brings us here, but I do feel strongly that there's a response purpose, that while we're here, the reason for our being here is revealed, that we do things, we engage with things that make a difference. And when we look back at our lives, hopefully we'll be able to say, that was it, that's why I was here. If anybody knows specifically now, please tell me how you found out. There's a great book called Illusions, Adventures of a Reluctant Messiah, written by Richard Bach, who wrote the more famous Jonathan Livingston Seagull. And in that book, there's this character who is the Messiah, and he carries with him the Messiah's handbook, which he looks through for wisdom. And it's one of those books that whatever page you open to, the thing you most need to learn is right there. And on one of the pages, it says, how do you know if the purpose for which you have chosen this life has been accomplished? If you are alive, it has not. In your opinion, what is the function, the role of a Sunday service in a youth church? In this church, how does that function differ from that of a mainline Protestant church, if there is any difference? For a while, there was a tendency for UUs to call their worship the celebration of life. And historically, if you trace the etymology of the word worship back far enough, you get something that's pronounced like worship, which means to lift up things of worth. And so in our tradition, what worship
what we do here on Sunday mornings is supposed to be is an opportunity for us to lift up things that are important that matter, and to look at them together, to explore them, to open each other's minds to seeing things in new ways. In the Protestant or in any monotheistic tradition, I think that's still the purpose, but the language and the metaphors used are that of whatever theistic tradition is. So Protestants will often say that the purpose of worship, the Christian thought, okay, is to worship God, to, you know, elevate God, and celebrate God. Which, if your definition of God is broad enough, I would say it's true for us too. So what is God but those things that are of work? What are those things that are of work? Sorry. You're already. How do we manage to sit? How do we manage the stress from difficult, long-standing problems like racism, poverty, and racism? Which is a serious question, because people who are engaged, actively engaged in activism, often burn out, and people who are not actively engaged in activism often feel the weight of things that they say, I should be doing something about this, and I'm not. And so I'd say again, places like this where we can connect with other people, so that when we're burned out, we can be connected with somebody who's on fire, and we can support one another. I think what I call a spiritual practice is something that helps ground us, helps ground you in being real. In the Hebrew scriptures, in the Psalms, there's a description of being like a deer that thirsts for water, or a tree that's planted near a river, and that there's that need to connect to that thing that sustains. I think also the long view is really important. Things need to change now. People, actual individual people, are being hurt now. And, as the phrase is, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. When I was lucky enough to spend some time overseas, I had 3 days in Paris. And as a matchmaker, one of the first things I wanted to do was see the gargoyles up close, so right up at the top of Notre Dame. And on the way through, there was a tour group, and they were being told that Notre Dame took 275 years or something like that to build. And when I was sitting on the roof, I found myself reflecting on that and thinking that that meant that the stonemasons who started knew that their grandchildren's grandchildren would be finishing. And yet they did their work with as much care as the ones who took the final touches on. And that image has always stayed with me, that we do what we can, while we can, and know that, trust that, the work will continue. And I think keeping that in mind is one way of getting the best set. From the number one name in acne care. Continuing with how do you deal with questions? How do you deal with doubt? Embrace it. The Buddhist tradition says that there are three meaningful things: great faith, great doubt, and great determination. I think that's cool. Great faith, great doubt, and great determination. Doubt means that we're open. That means that we haven't narrowed our thinking to a way that we are certain that this is it. And if you look around at both current events and the history of humanity, whenever people have been certain that this is it, bad things happen. So doubt is a tremendous gift, however disorienting it might be. Last week I talked about circus imagery. One of the things that is an act in a lot of big circuses is somebody standing on a giant globe, balancing on it. And the secret to that is you don't balance on a globe, you constantly move slightly, adjusting your balance, because the ball is moving under you. Similarly, if you're holding a stick, you don't just hold it. You're constantly moving when you're really good, just subtle little movements. The world moves, the world changes. And so the only way you can look through it is to also be willing to make sometimes subtle, sometimes huge movements to stay in some kind of equilibrium with it. Because if you don't, if you're on the ball and you don't move, you fall. Guaranteed, no question. Doubt is a way of keep. Is our spiritual community a dynamic one, or anchored in the past doctrine, unable to untether itself from that doctrine? Yes.
The final answer is up to you.
What's God? Yes. I have often said that in our tradition, experience precedes theology. And what I mean by that is in a lot of religious traditions, there is a theology that tells you the answer to what's God, or what's life, what's this, what's that. And your role upon hearing these things and accepting these as truth is to look for examples of that in the world. So this is what God is like. Look for God. I believe that our tradition says, what's your life like? What have been your experiences that have felt sacred, that felt powerfully moving, that felt transformative? That's God. And so we say, start with your life, look for the sacred, and then that should be your definition of God, or the sacred, or the holy. And part of what's cool about our tradition is we don't expect us to all have the same definition. So at our best, when we're not tethered to past doctrine, ours or the movement, at our best, we listen to each other with open, curious minds because we are somewhat doubtful of our own experience and our own definition. So we listen to each other, and I hear something you say, and you go, wow, I'm going to add that to my definition. Does that make sense? Or I'll hear something somebody else say, go, oh, I hadn't realized that's a problem with my definition. I'm going to let that go. So, again, the answer is with you. The reverse question being what you think God is. And then let's talk about our different interpretations. When I was doing my chaplaincy training, one of the things that happened a lot, you'd go into a patient's room, and they would see you in the chaplain, and they'd say, okay, chaplain, you don't need to come in. I don't believe in God. And my teacher said that the best response was, tell me about this God you don't believe in. I probably don't believe in that God either. And then you get into this great conversation about what God is not. And that leads you. I remember a conversation with somebody who's like, I don't believe in spirituality. And I said, well, what do you believe in? And their answer was the most spiritual thing I had ever heard in my life. And I reflected that back and said, I don't know who taught you what spirituality means, but you just described it. I was saying, please pass. I got a couple at the end. The statement on the other side of this card is false. The statement on the other side of this card is false. That is a good definition of God. Saint Thomas Aquinas, I think, one of the great church fathers, said that we cannot say what God is. I'm going to ask that question. That we can only say what God is not. Because anytime we say God is this, we limit God. And so God is not that. So he said the only way we can speak about God is in metaphor or in negations. God is not this. God is not that. whatever you think is true, this brings us back to doubt, too. Whatever you think is true is not. And, yeah, I remember when I write it out, I remember when I don't. I served, the first congregation I served for 11 years, so I preached a lot of sermons. And on my last Sunday there, my sermon was titled, Everything I've Said Was Wrong. And I went back over 11 years of sermons and said, you know how I kept saying life is a journey? Well, it's not, because we don't go anywhere. Life is like a tree, ever expanding. Remember when I said this? But that's not true. Life is like, and so I went through all the major themes I ever touched on in 11 years of preaching. And my last sermon was a negation of all of them, because if you look at it from over here, that wasn't true, this is. Which again is one of the things that's great about our tradition is we all look at it from different places, and if we can listen to each other, our own understandings can expand. Wow, that could be the last question. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I've put them all to this. Where are all the single cisgender straight men? Anyone? Do you mean the good ones or the ones to stay away from? Where are all the anyways? Where is the anything? I don't think I believe that we come with a purpose. I think we discover purpose. I don't think things that happen to us happen because of some meaning. I think that because things happen, we discover meaning. And I don't think there is the person we're going to meet, but I think we can meet the person. And I don't think there's any way to make that happen and to try to wrap things up. Whether that person is a single cisgender straight man, or whether that person is God, how we discover the truth of this encounter, how we discover the reality of relationship, is part of the journey that we just heard about. And one of the questions is, are we willing to do that?
Become a teacher, they stand before the Sangha and the Sangha asks some questions. It's called Dharma Combat. And the intent is to see what is the depth of understanding of this monk. What does she or he know inside? I've also learned that it's really interesting what questions come out of a congregation. And so I think that too is an interesting revelation. And that's why, although I probably will not get to all of your questions, and you didn't hear the questions from 9:15, I will be putting all of them in an upcoming blog post. So you can see one of the things we as a community thought were worth asking. So, shuffle. See what we get. What's the most important purpose for UU churches to exist? We are a funny group. I think all religious communities, I think all the things we humans have done to try to answer the questions that come up, grappling with what Colleague Forrest Church calls the realization that there's birth and there's death, and we gotta figure out what's in between. All the different religions we have ever created are attempts to grapple with that and then to do something with the answers we find. Unitarian Universalism, in my experience, is unique in that we don't start with what do you believe as a focal point. We start with what world do you want to create? What's the vision of beloved community? And if we share a vision, let's call each other kin. The second question is, what do we believe? Because it's really interesting to find out that this person has that vision because Christ died for their sins. And this person has that vision because all things have Buddha nature. And this person has that vision because it's only us, folks, and if we don't do it, nobody's going to. And learning from each other, seeing how the world looks from different perspectives, not as a threat, not as an attempt to prove them wrong, but as a way of deepening our own experience. Only we do that. And so I think the primary purpose of UU congregations is to create places like that. I don't usually take follow-up questions, but what is your favorite soul and why? I cross-stitched my first soul that the congregation I was ordained by gave me as my gift, and I also then cross-stitched this beautiful soul, blue fabric, two U's at the bottom of them with Celtic rope in them, and then flames that came up like this. And the reason you've never seen it is when the minister of our partner church in that congregation, when he came to visit, he gave me a beautiful stole that was stitched in the Transylvanian style, and I gave him that stole, and then discovered that clergy there don't wear stoles. So it's my favorite because it's the one that got away. What worries you most? And or what keeps your hopes up?
Simple question.
Yeah. So I'd say two things. One big, one small, of what I worry about most. One is how many people are going to be hurt between now and when we do create that beloved community that I believe will eventually be created. But between now and then, so many people and so many things, our planet, are going to be hurt. And I worry about just how many there will be. The more closer to home is, I should have qualified when I said we UUs are unique in this way. I should have said, at our best, that's who we are. I worry that we're often not at our best, and that we, even here, look at each other's different beliefs and believe we're right, they're wrong, and try to convince each other of that. And if that's all we're going to do, we probably shouldn't be doing this. And what keeps my hopes up? Carl Sandburg said that every time a baby is born, it's proof that God has not given up on the world yet. And that's got to be a good answer from me. What question should a 70-year-old person thinking about the end of life ask? I want to say, what would you like to know? But I think from my not yet 70,
your old perspective, so I'm limited in my ability to comprehend. I would ask, how many of the good things can I remember? How many of the moments of love that I gave and that I received are on the tip of my tongue? How much joy can I hold on to? That's what I want. Okay, another one about aging and dying, so I'm going to... Are we considering joining the UU Sanctuary Church movement? Yes. Just what that means, how we're going to do it, is part of the considering, There is, in the national sanctuary movement, there's debate as to whether or not what many of us think of as sanctuary churches, what was done in the past, whether that's still the most effective way of serving the immigrant community, partly because the current administration may not follow the practice of treating holy places like churches, schools, other such places as sacred and not send in ICAs. And so public sanctuary in congregations may not be the way to do it this time around. But we are certainly looking into what that would look like for us, what this community means. What is the most fun thing I've done so far this year? I flew around Charlottesville with my 15-year-old son at the controls. What happens to me, my spirit, soul, being, after I die? So far, I was going through, there are a lot of questions about death and aging in this group, which I think is really important for us as a congregation to be aware of. I don't know is probably the best answer I can give. There's an Omaha Nation saying that I use at the beginning of most memorial services, which says something to the effect of those old ones who've gone to the place where death stands waiting have not pointed out a way to circumvent it. And it's also said that those who have made that haven't been able to tell us what that was like. So I don't know. What I do know is that through lived experience, who we are somehow continues. Life and love do not stop when the body stops. I don't understand it, could not explain it, but through my own lived experience and through that of many people that I've talked with and lived with over the years, there's something, I call it the sacred something, that continues. And maybe it's just holding loving memories, but I'll tell you, my own experience with my parents' death, it's more than that. So I don't know is the answer. How would you describe the holy? Carefully. Moving on. Why is it that we are eager to call out the faults we see in others, but do so little to correct the faults in ourselves that we know exist? Because it's easier. And probably because there are so many faults in us that we don't know exist, and we often trip over those on the way of trying to deal with the ones we do. And I heard, this was years ago now, that the psychology department at Harvard, I believe, did an experiment where they asked, and I don't remember the details of the experiment, but they asked people to list their favorite traits about themselves, what they were most proud of. And then they also asked people to rate to list the things they were most upset by, disturbed by, troubled by, ashamed of. And almost invariably, the two lists were mirrors of each other. So somebody would say, I just can't get organized. But I love how flexible I am. And so their hypothesis coming out of it is one of the reasons it is so hard to change the faults we find in ourselves is because they're the flip side of the things we're most proud of. And figuring out how to dance with that, it's hard. So it's a lot easier to just point out other people's mistakes. What is the biggest risk you'd like to see our congregation take this year? Moving on. I would like to see us, and I mean us, I include myself in this, I would like to see us in every situation where it's possible, risk showing and saying who we are. I think at every level, we are like everybody else in wanting to protect the image of who we are. And so we don't risk sharing that. And we UUs are so concerned with offending people that we also don't show who we are because that might offend somebody who is different or thinks differently. At the spiritual level, I used to always say we are able to embrace so many spiritual traditions because we have a spiritual don't ask, don't tell policy. And people get along because I won't tell you what I believe, you won't tell me what you believe, and so we can assume we all kind of believe more or less the same thing. I would like to see us really dig in to the conversations that really matter and to stop individually and as a community getting caught up in making Colleen call from the sermon that I really want everybody to listen to, what she calls the fake fights. The things that we think are important and that are so much easier to deal with. Like bylaws changes, or the color of the walls, or how we do joys and sorrows, or things that really aren't the issue. And instead, in every opportunity we have to risk digging in and say, this is who I am. Who are you? How is that? In the last service, somebody asked, where are all the straight cis male single men? I invited people to email me if they had questions that either weren't going to be here or just want to make sure I got them. And one email question I got was, could you please explain the meanings behind the sixfold amen? So each week I conclude the time of prayer, closing prayer, by saying, blessed be, namaste, assalamu alaikum, ashe, shalom, amen. So blessed be is frequently used within the Wiccan tradition, but a lot of Earth-centered traditions use blessed be. But it's the root of a whole bunch of other prayer ending phrases. Namaste is mostly from the Hindu tradition, and it has various interpretations, but most commonly it's the God in me sees the God in you. And this hand position, in fact, is also sometimes known as a namaste. And in that case, the metaphor is you and I are one thing. Assalamu alaikum is Arabic. It is the greeting most often used by Muslims when they meet one another, and it means peace be upon you. Ashe comes from the Yoruba people of Africa, and it means power to it. And it's a way of ending a prayer to say the intentions of this may they have power and force. Shalom means peace and amen also, oddly enough, means power to it and blessed be and peace be upon you. And so it's a. When you have only a few minutes to respond, if somebody asks, what is Unitarian Universalism? How do you answer? Carefully. I love to say Unitarian Universalism is a post-Christian, non-creedal congregation-based religious tradition. Because I'm a Glenn Harvard. I didn't go to college for nothing. It cost me thousands of dollars. I would say that Unitarian Universalism, at its best, is a faith community like what I just said, a faith community that starts with a vision of the world. And that what we believe as individuals, while interesting and informative, is not for us a device effect.
Don't let a scar steal your spotlight. Mederma Advanced Scar Gel is the only once-daily scar care product clinically shown to reduce scar appearance, making it one of the most cost-effective...
Why doesn't our current... That's actually a really good formulation utilizes patented ingredients to improve the appearance... Why doesn't our congregation require people to contribute back into our community, whether financially or through volunteer time? Maybe we wouldn't struggle so much if everyone contributed.
If you don't sit in your lucky seat, your team could lose. So don't leave your lucky seat. But do pick up your phone and computer and order...
Because not everyone can contribute in the same way. And I've often said when people... I've been doing this for 20 years. And over that 20 years, not a year has gone by where multiple people haven't come to me and said a version of, I want to play a play. What I'm going through right now, I can't commit to doing anything. And I have always said, you know, letting us help you, that's doing something. Because those of us who want to give, if we didn't have any recipients, we couldn't give. So simply being present, showing up, is doing something. And I believe that so everyone contributes to this community. We don't require specific things. Apparently before I got here, there was a debate about whether to require financial giving, pledging as part of membership. And I think quite wisely, you said no. Because if we are who we say we are, if we're that community that comes together with a shared vision of the world, why would we require something and the same thing of every person who wants to be part of the community? That doesn't make sense. Expect it, yes. And we need to get a lot better as a community of saying, we expect our members to support this place financially if that's possible, with your time if that's possible. But in some way, you really ought to be giving back, or what the heck does membership mean to you? I think we ought to say that, but to say you have to, I don't think that would work. And I don't think that would solve the problems we have in terms of not enough volunteers or not enough budget. I don't think that's the solution to that. All right. Why is the church still named after a slaveholder who had children with one of his slaves if we are a church that promotes racial justice? How long will it take for us to truly see the white privilege and racism of our history? Really good question. One that this congregation has wrestled with for a while now. And I would say, my own personal response is that it would be too easy to change our name. Because if we changed our name, we could say, look at this great thing we've done. And then after a few years of being the Charlottesville Unitarian Universalist Church, we'd be the Charlottesville Unitarian Universalist Church. But as the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church, I think it gives us, makes an obligation to us to address that history. Because we're named after a slaveholder. So we got to do something about this. And I think that impetus to do something because of that legacy, could very well be lessened if not erased, if we erase that name. On the placards that are out in the foyer, there are some really great, great quotes that take a look at, and they, I think, speak to also why holding that heritage could be a good thing for us. I also think that in terms of the wider community, for the Unitarian Universalist Church of Charlottesville to do serious racial justice work, not where you use, you expect that. But the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church doing serious racial justice work, that's a, that seems like an oxymoron. And that's cool, because that is another way of demonstrating. And the third reason is we're right now in conversation with the outreach director at Monticello. And we're talking about ways that programs they do there, maybe we could take them off the mountain and bring them into city here. We couldn't do that if we weren't the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church. We have connections to this community that our name gives us entree to. And then we can go in and be subversive and do things that we couldn't if we were there. Star Trek or Star Wars? Yes.
Batman.
Wonder Woman, although I can't do a really good Wonder Woman impression for lots of reasons. What question are you living with now? Are you living with now? In the way of a wealthy reading suggests. Remember that. I'm aware of how far my actual living and my vision of how I should be living are from one another. And there are more than a few Sundays where I come in here and think, why does anybody think I know anything about any of this? If they know what I just said to my kids last night, when they would get off the Xbox, they would not listen to me talk about peace and joy. And while I know that's a human thing, and if any of you came to me to say, I'm having this wrestling match, I would say, well, that's a human thing, don't worry about it. I worry about it. And that's the question I'm trying hard to live with. All right, I think I have time for a couple more. So why do you eat fire? Last week I did say, because it's cool, and for those who weren't here, the metaphor that my teacher and her teacher said was, when you eat fire, you demonstrate that you can take something that is frightening, something that's actually dangerous, and instead of running away from it or pushing it away from you, you can move towards it and bring it close to you, and in doing so, something beautiful happens. And that's the thing that we can all find places in our lives to remember. Reprise Love Shack? No. That was a one-time event. Although my son has edited the video together, and so we really get to see it. So I'm going to end with this one. Why are we here? Why to listen to this sermon, of course. So the question of do we have a purpose in life is one that I get asked a lot. You know, what is my purpose? Why am I here? Why do bad things happen to good people? And I personally do not believe that things happen for a reason. I do not believe that bad things happen to teach me a lesson, or that I am here because God wants me to, whatever. What I do believe, though, is because things happen, I learn lessons. And so because this bad thing happened, I learned a lesson. And because I'm here on this planet, I've done things. And I don't believe that the purpose precedes my life. I think it follows it. And this might bring us back to the question of what is somebody who's facing death at? Why was I here? What did I do in this life? Where are the differences made? And I think that that's the only place the answer can come from, is looking back over my life. What does it mean? Why was I here? And knowing that we're going to look back at it can inform the way we live it now, so that when we ask that question, we are going to have a good answer. Thank you.